Good morning, I'm Tommy Halm, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9, a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program for the listeners of FM 94.9 in San Diego and all of Southern California, from the beaches to the mountains to the deserts. This is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. The Monterey Bay Marine Sanctuary off the central coast of California recently expanded its borders to include one of the largest undersea mountains in U.S. waters, a dormant undersea volcano called the Davidson Seamount. And along with the surrounding coral forests, the 585-square-mile addition to the sanctuary will safeguard an extraordinary array of ocean creatures. Now, that's on the federal end of things. The passage of the Marine Life Protection Act by the state of California back in 1999 ensured the creation of special, state-designated undersea places where fishing is to be limited, not unlike a national park or wilderness area. So how do all the designations play out, and what do they mean? And do these undersea reserves and sanctuaries really offer an opportunity for oceanic conservation? Or are many of these areas just parks on paper with no means of enforcement? Well, joining us today to talk all about the Marine Life Protection Act and underwater sanctuaries and reserves is Kate Hanley from San Diego Coastkeeper. Kate is the Director of Marine Conservation at San Diego Coastkeeper, and she's also a member of the Southern California Regional Stakeholder Group for the Marine Life Protection Act. Also joining us today is Nigella Hilgarth. Nigella is the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium at Scripps. We are very, very honored to have the two of you here today. We don't spend much time talking about the sea on Tree Huggers International, so today I think we're going to be more kelp huggers. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
How are the oceans doing right now? Are the oceans in good shape? Are they in better shape? Are they healthy right now?
Well, unfortunately, I think in many cases the ocean isn't doing so great these days. Even just referencing a study that came out from Dr. Boris Worm, I think it's about 3 or 4 years ago now, which stated in the past 50 years alone, 90% of large oceanic fish, looking at tuna, swordfish, marlin, have decreased by 90%. I mean, these are just shocking levels. So essentially we have 10% of, you know, historic levels of large predatory fish. In California, fishermen are now catching less than half of what they did in 1990, and the fish they do catch are 45% smaller. So in a relatively short period of time, almost 70% of giant kelp forests, which are key habitat for healthy fish populations, have vanished. That's within a relatively short period of time, too. I think the studies that they've shown are between 30 and 50 years, so we've lost a significant amount of kelp canopy. And some fish populations off California have been depleted to 10% of historic levels, kind of same as what we're looking at globally, and may take 50 to 80 years to recover to healthy, sustainable levels. We could even just point to recently, within the past 10, 15 years, major rock fishery closures off the coast of California. And I'm sure that a lot of the researchers at Scripps who do work internationally have seen similar trends.
Oh, yes, internationally and locally. And Dr. Paul Dayton, who is renowned for his work on the local kelp forest, has seen enormous change over the last few decades. And his work is being continued by Ed Parnell in the local reserve in La Jolla and elsewhere. And the size of the fish are much smaller, as Kate said. Everywhere internationally, we're finding the same thing. We're finding the same problem with our coral reefs. So this, it's not just in California, but this is where we're focusing on at the moment.
Well, why are fish turning up smaller? Is this purely due to fishing? Is this overfishing? Does pollution have a lot to do with this?
I think traditionally it's been very much that you took the large fish and you threw the smaller ones back in the ocean. And what we didn't understand then was actually it's the larger fish that tend to reproduce the most. The bigger they get, the higher their fecundity. In other words, the more eggs they produce. And so we really should have been throwing the big ones back and taking the little ones.
And then coral is also being affected as well. Is this because smaller fish are being tossed back into the ocean, so to speak?
Pollution is part of the problem, especially in some parts of the world. It's also erosion of the soil, so you're getting some of the reefs are covered. But it's a much bigger problem with the coral reefs. It also is really the fact that the oceans are warming up in some areas. It's global warming problems that are causing what we know as bleaching of coral reefs, which means that the algae that live in the coral are dying off, and so they're not providing this rich habitat. And so the fish are disappearing from the reefs, too.
And the Marine Life Protection Act, was that meant to address some of these concerns?
Yes, it was. More with looking at ecosystem-based management, you know, when we're talking about fish or extraction. Water quality does, of course, come into play with it. I mean, you can't stick your head in the sand and just say, oh, that's, you know, that's not a factor at all, especially in Southern California. That's probably the number one issue that really impacts the ecosystem here. The primary thrust of the act is to take a comprehensive look at how we can protect entire ecosystems rather than kind of piecemealing it where let's just look at one species of fish or one particular ecosystem or water quality.
Is there a similar federal designation as well?
There are complementary federal marine reserves, which they're trying to connect these disparate marine protected areas across the nation and have one comprehensive, cohesive marine protected area system for the United States.
They would kind of function like wildlife corridors.
I think that's the hope eventually. Certainly in the state of California, what they're doing through the Marine Life Protection Act, they want a cohesive network of marine reserve, which would provide something similar to a biological corridor underwater, yes.
Fish stocks can recover and invertebrates can recover. It's like a national park underwater, and I think that's what we need to create in order to protect our wildlife on the coasts and inside the ocean.
Are most of these areas big enough to really allow fish populations to rebound to where they should be?
The exciting part of what's happening right now is that there is a really unique debate going on with participation from every single entity that's interested, every single area from the commercial fishermen to the sports fishermen, to the recreational users, to the scientists, interested citizens. This is the opportunity where we can really look at the data and we can really designate proper areas that are the right size that we need.
Then, Nigella, you mentioned how some of these areas can be comparable to a national park or wilderness area. And Kate, when we were talking, you'd mentioned it was sort of like an underwater Yosemite. Can you expand
sure.
on that a little bit?
Well, and to put another analogy in the mix, I almost see it also as a savings account. You know, so that you have something for a rainy day. And I just wanted to, you know, even just use this as a for instance, where scientific studies have shown of over 124 marine reserves worldwide, 53 of which have ocean temperatures similar to California, so a temperate ecosystem, have shown that protecting areas from fishing and extractive uses, sort of this savings account, really do make a difference. These studies shown that reserves placed in these habitats allow the number of plants and animals to more than triple and boost individual sizes by an average of 27%, which Nigella was talking about, the importance of what's known as BOFs, or big, old, fat females, because they really do produce significant amounts of eggs, and that's what we need to keep things going in the system. And everyone does benefit from having these systems in place because there's an effect known as spillover. So if you have more numerous fish in these reserves and they're larger, they're producing more eggs, you'll often see fishermen doing what's known as fishing the line, where they're just on the outskirts of these reserves and just reaping the bounty of that. So it really does serve as a bank account. Same with, you know, you'll find a lot of people who hunt right on the outskirts of some of our national parks. Same kind of thinking there.
Well, I just wanted to say I'd never thought of it that way as a savings account. That's a great analogy. I like that
oh,
a lot.
Thank you. Live off the interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I want to talk a little bit about how the fishing industry responds to the Marine Life Protection Act and this idea. But let's talk about real quickly the three different types of marine reserves. Can you explain those?
Absolutely, I can. You have marine parks, which allow some recreational fishing. You have marine reserves, where fish, wildlife, and habitats are protected from all fishing and resource extraction, meaning you can't go in and take anything. And then you have marine conservation areas, which are quite common, and there's some consumptive recreational and commercial activities allowed. And the one in La Jolla is a great, for instance, the state marine conservation there, you're not allowed to take fish for recreational purposes. You're not even really allowed to take a shell out of there, but there is a squid fishery on the northwest corner, I believe.
Now, that was established some 35 years ago, the one off of La Jolla.
71. It was actually really through Scripps scientists at Scripps Institution of Oceanography decided that that was such an important area to conserve. It also has the La Jolla Canyon, of course, and so it has very rich biodiversity.
And has it been protected in a way that was intended?
You know, there are incursions into these reserves. It's very hard to actually monitor them on a constant basis. We don't have the resources to do that. And I think that's one of the questions that's being raised at the moment about MPAs and how they can be monitored.
Is there a point that was brought up by the fishing industry that was really not taken into account when this legislation was originally put together?
I've heard that it was the fishermen who requested that this legislation be implemented in the first place because of the rock fishery closures in the 90s. I mean, it's just disastrous. And when they began seeing these serious changes in the ocean, you know, that's when it was like, we need a call to action now. People say, well, why do we need this? It's just me and my grandson going out and doing recreational fishing, or, you know, I'm just one small commercial boat operator. But there are 25 million people from Santa Barbara down to San Diego. So it might just be your line in the water, but many, many other people are also extracting from the same resource. And it's just, as we see in terrestrial systems, as well as, you know, in the marine environment, it's just a lot of pressure from humans. And so that's kind of created a tipping point. That's where we are now.
Part of the problem is we, for so long, thought of the ocean as an infinite resource that we could just go on taking and taking, and that somehow it was so big that it wouldn't impact it. And we've seen a really quite sudden and dramatic fall off, particularly because fish get flown around all over the world for eating, for commercial purposes. It's only been a really abrupt change, and it's not just in California, it's everywhere.
And this might be a simple question, so you'll have to forgive me, but why are large fish population so important? I mean, I understand you need a lot of fish to sort of create new fish, but why are large fish populations important to the health of the sea?
I would say kind of an obvious answer would be genetic diversity. When you have more species, you know, in an area and you have more individual species, that's allowing for genetic diversity, which then allows for, if there is something catastrophic that occurs, even just like a disease, then it's not going to wipe out the entire population. That's why there's something in ecology called a 5,500 rule. If you're down to 50 individuals, your chances of them getting through that is little to none, slim to none, because the genetic diversity isn't there. And you need about 500 individuals to be able to, you know, say, okay, this is, they're going to make it and it'll be robust. So I think it's the same thing in the ocean. I mean, you know, a different environment, obviously, and there's more factors to consider as well. But I don't know, Nigel, if you have.
I think it's a fascinating question, and Kate's answer is absolutely right. I think there are other things that you can take into account. And if you look at a coral reef, for example, and you remove a lot of the large fish, you remove the animals that are grazing the algae off the coral. That's another reason why it kills it. So you're killing the whole system. And, you know, if you alter the balance in ways that we still don't understand, you can get big problems. A lot of people don't realize that we get 50% of our oxygen from the ocean. And so these are really important things to consider when you start removing the fish. You're not sure what you're doing. But there are many, many millions of people around the world that depend on fish, either as a total diet or to make a living. I mean, I think it's something we really, really need to care, not just in California, but everywhere. It is a major part of the world economy.
And the absence of one species eventually is going to affect the rest of the critters as well.
Absolutely.
Oh, yes.
And we've seen that even in California. There used to be sea otter populations all the way down the coast into Mexico, and then they were hunted almost to extinction because of their pelts. And so now what you have is you don't have what they call an apex predator to remove the sea urchins. So sea otters eat sea urchins, and then the sea urchins are just mowing down the kelp. So then the urchin fishermen come in and they say, well, we've basically taken the place of the sea otter and we are the apex predator. But it is an ecosystem out of balance, out of whack.
Are there other countries that have adopted similar programs that have seen success rates? I mean, are there other nations that are really taking a lead on marine sanctuaries?
I went to school in Australia on the Great Barrier Reef, and what they've done in Australia is amazing with the Great Barrier Reef and the management there. But New Zealand, I do want to point out, they have done a phenomenal job with implementing marine protected areas. The MPAs in New Zealand have supplied surrounding waters with larger and more lobster. In many places, this has led to what fishermen refer to as fishing the line, as I mentioned, and they say the best fishing usually occurs just outside the MPA border. So about 30 years ago, when they started their whole marine protected area system, people were up in arms about this. Fishermen were like, you've got to be kidding me. What are these things going in? You're going to affect my livelihood. And now they're the biggest advocates of marine protected areas. And I've been to lectures where not only scientists, but fishermen from New Zealand just come forward and they say, we were scared of this. We didn't want this. We thought this was crazy. And now look at what we have. I think it's similar to, you know, we talk about national parks. And 100 years ago, when Teddy Roosevelt said mandatory 5% of U.S. land set aside, people thought he was crazy. Like, that was just such a, like, why? Why would you do that? And he had the foresight to say, we need these as seed areas, as wilderness areas, they need to be set aside. And so, you know, we need to be the generation that makes the difference and does this for the ocean, so that in 100 years, people will be like, thank goodness someone did that 100 years ago.
There are, in Europe, around the Mediterranean, there are several marine protected areas at different kinds and levels. And just as Kate was saying, I gather they've been very successful at creating public support and interest and increasing fishing stocks rather than the opposite.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. I'm Tommy Howe, and joining us today are Kate Hanley, the Director of Marine Conservation with San Diego Coastkeeper and a member of the Southern California Regional Stakeholder Group for the Marine Life Protection Act. And also joining us is Nigella Hilgarth, the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium at Scripps. We're talking about the benefits of the Marine Life Protection Act and the science behind it. How do you apply an enforcement apparatus to the Marine Life Protection Act?
To me, one of the things that's so exciting about what's happening now and getting everyone on board to this, my hope is that there'll be a lot of self-policing here, that this is something that if you really have all the fishermen involved and you have the commercial and the sport recreational folks working together, that we're going to be able to do this ourselves, because I don't think there are going to be a lot of state and federal resources to help. But it's in everybody's interests to actually keep these marine protected areas protected.
As a person on the regional stakeholder group, that's probably the biggest concern that's been vocalized, and understandably so. No one wants these to be a paper park. You know, we want to see these succeed, and I think fishermen do as well. So, you know, I think it is citizen enforcement, people calling in if there is a violation. And then also, it's funny because I think throughout this process, there are people who have emerged or different entities that I just wouldn't even think about as enforcement. I gave a presentation to the San Diego lifeguards a couple weeks ago, and they're like, our eyes are on the water all the time, and we call in violations every day, well, not every day, but like every few weeks. So we're kind of the eyes and ears of these marine protected areas for you guys. So how do we work together, and how do we work with Department of Fish and Game, which we're already doing on some level? So I think it's everyone from, you know, you're out in a boat mm-hmm. and you see someone fishing inside a reserve, you make the call to Department of Fish and Game, or the lifeguards.
That's
watching
great
from the shore.
About the lifeguards and the coast guards. I didn't realize they played such a big role.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was really surprised to hear that as well, but pleasantly surprised.
Now, when the Marine Life Protection Act was being debated, I mean, was there some argument about saying, you know, we've already got these fisheries regulations on the books. If we just follow these regulations, why do we need these reserves set aside?
People have talked about that, but, you know, the proof is kind of in the pudding. We have so many fishery collapses and closures that it's not working. I mean, what we've learned, I think, in the past 15, 20 years is that ecosystems are resilient, but they need to be managed well, and that's kind of our role as stewards of the environment. And you can't just, you know, take a look at an ecosystem and be like, okay, we just need to protect this one fish, because everything else suffers. And that's what we've been doing with fisheries management, is fishing to maximum sustainable yield, which means how much can I fish, like down to the very last fish before, and maximize, you know, what I can take out of this in terms of, you know, getting my economic benefit, but to still keep the populations alive. It hasn't worked. You know, 160 scientists signed a consensus statement stating that marine reserves are a highly effective but underappreciated and underutilized tool that can help alleviate the declining state of the ocean. If fishery management alone worked, we wouldn't even be in this situation right now.
In 1980, when Channel Islands National Park was established off of the Central Coast, off of Ventura County, Santa Barbara County, it had an undersea component to it as well. And I believe that was unique for the national park system at that time. Can you talk a little bit about those undersea areas protected in mm-hmm. that national park?
I think it was like the early 70s that a lot of these parks are being established. And some, you're correct, were an extension of like the state parks, and they wanted to put that in the ocean as well. What's interesting is, and through this process, we've kind of modernized it. It's more, you know, not knocking what they did back then, but this is working with scientists to figure out where marine protected areas should go and what are going to be the beneficial long-term uses. So in 2003, they designated 12 marine protected areas at the Channel Islands. The marine protected areas now cover 142 square nautical miles and include 10 fully protected marine reserves. And, you know, people, again, were freaked out about that, and what are the socioeconomic impacts, and it's quite amazing. In a relatively short period of time, the density of fish is 1.5 times higher inside the reserves than outside. On average, the fish are larger. Kelp forests around the islands have increased, resulting in more and larger fish, such as the California sheephead. What they have found, too, is no significant economic losses have been experienced despite initial predictions saying otherwise. And it's actually increased sport fishing and commercial catch in the Channel Islands since the establishment of marine protected areas. So all good news. I think change for anyone is a little bit uncomfortable at first, but hanging in there for the relatively short time and reaping the benefits 5 years later, it's going to be good for everyone.
Can you talk about the importance of kelp forests and what do kelp forests provide to the coastal environment and marine sanctuaries, and how do they help sea life?
Kelp forests are like our rainforests, if you like, under the ocean. They are incredibly exciting wildernesses that we have just by our doorstep. And yes, they provide an amazing habitat for a lot of animals that can live not only on the kelp, but they can also live off all the invertebrates that live in the kelp. Just an enormous smorgasbord of food, if you like, for a lot of the fish that live in the kelp forest. It also provides protection.
You know, to think of it as a rainforest is a great analogy, because most people don't get underneath the water, right? So what is it like? You just see this stuff kind of glistening on the surface. But if you're a diver or someone, you know, even just snorkeling, you'll just see that's amazing abundance and a prime habitat, or the primary habitat for fish in Southern California. That's where you'll find most congregations of species.
And if you don't dive or snorkel, not only should you learn, but you should also come to the Verge Aquarium, because we have a huge kelp tank, about 70,000 gallons, where we have recreated a kelp forest of really about 40 years ago, what you would have seen before a lot of the large fish were taken out. And so you can see in beautiful clear water a lot of the main species you would find, the black sea bass, the sheephead, the state marine fish, the Garibaldi, and really understand a bit about how that ecosystem works. And we have live kelp plants, and you can see that they are not the sort of tangled mass that you get at the beach and get a bit scared about. They are beautiful, beautiful trees, really, if you like. They are seaweed, but they are growing these huge, massive plants in the ocean, and they are beautiful. They really are.
Well, and Nigella, being the executive director of the Birch Aquarium, can you talk just for a moment about the Birch Aquarium's input into the Marine Life Protection Act and what the Birch Aquarium really brings to the table?
Well, as you know, the Birch Aquarium is the educational arm of Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And so we're just thrilled to be able to really make the public aware of the marine protected areas and the initiative going ahead that they can all take a part in. So we have collaborated with other aquariums in Southern California, with the Aquarium of the Pacific, Cabrillo Aquarium, also the Ocean Institute at Dana Point, to have a series of lectures, and which some of them are also now on our website, which is aquarium.ucsd.edu. And you can also have a link there to a page which really summarizes everything you want to know about marine protected areas and how you can get involved and how you can make public comment. So it has all the links that you would need there. Also links to these other aquariums that are also doing educational initiatives of various kind. Maybe it's education programs or family days or lectures. And also we are creating an exhibit that each aquarium will have, which summarizes marine protected areas and their importance. So aquariums can be a great educational resource to get the word out here. That's what we're trying to do at the aquarium.
And that's at aquarium.ucsd.edu.
That's right.
And Kate, is there a particular website that people can go to learn more about the Marine Life Protection Act?
Sure. First of all, I do want to say, because I'm the Director of Marine Conservation at San Diego Coastkeeper, looking at the Coastkeeper website, because we're basically one-stop shopping for coastal protection in San Diego County. We're the largest professional group that's working on coastal issues. We do everything from beach cleanups. We do water monitoring in 11 watersheds here in San Diego County. Through our work, we've helped to reduce sewage spills by 87% in the past 8 years.
That's why I love you guys. You keep this city and this county honest.
Oh, boy.
That's why I love San Diego Coastkeeper. Good.
You know, I mean, that's just sort of a snapshot.
That's sdcoastkeeper.org.
I also just wanted to state, in a recent poll done by the Public Policy Institute of California, 71% of Californians stated that they wanted more marine reserves off the coast of California, expressing to me that people do want to get involved. And I would encourage them to do so through attending these meetings, having their voices heard, certainly, you know, letting the Department of Fish and Game and the Marine Life Protection Act Initiative staff know what matters to them and how they feel that this should kind of play out in terms of where these marine protected areas should be. I would encourage folks to go to dfg.ca.gov/MLPA. Another great website to check out is caloceans.org, caloceans.org.
And we'll post those up on the website.
Wonderful.
That's dfg.ca.gov/MLPA and caloceans.org.
You got it.
And also sdcoastkeeper.org.
We didn't realize the traditional pyramid or apex that you talk about ecology, which on land is you have only a few large creatures at the top, the large predators. It's the other way around in the ocean. You have a lot of a pristine coral reef. You've got lots of sharks, lots of big fish, and relatively small numbers of tiny fish. They're eaten by the big predators. It's like the grass is cropped short all the time. And that is completely opposite to what we thought until very recently. And so it's those kind of discoveries that sort of blow my mind, because it makes me realize we still don't know very much about that wonderful ocean out there. It doesn't work necessarily the way things on land work.
We've been to the moon, we just don't know that much about the sea.
We know more about the surface of Mars than we do about the bottom of the ocean off our shore here.
And certainly the bottom of some of those trenches.
Oh, well, there,
that's a long way
anything
down.
Anything could be down there.
I did an undergraduate degree from University of Maryland for 5 years and just was very entrenched in research. And then I went to James Cook University in Australia and had an amazing experience there looking at what was happening on the Great Barrier Reef and just more single species research, though. And so my head was in that for many years. But after I finished graduate school, I was working in the Florida Keys as a marine biologist. And again, just doing my research in a lab. And I'm a diver, and my dad used to take me fishing in the Florida Keys from when I was 4 years old. And even just seeing a change in, 20 years at that time, I was like, whoa. So, I just kind of woke up one day and I was like, here I am diving, doing this research, working on shrimp like pinnaeids and different fish. And I just feel like there's a disconnect between the research, the amazing research that's happening, like the research that's going on at Scripps, and people understanding the importance that there's an ocean revolution going on. The oceans are showing serious signs of distress, decline, and we need to make that connection between the science and then letting people know actually what's happening. Because, you look at the ocean, you just look at the surface, you look at sunsets, but those of us who actually do research on and under the ocean, whole different story. And that's when I had an epiphany and said, I really need to get into the education outreach nonprofit realm and be able to express these concerns that the scientists have to, other mediums, which is what the Birch Aquarium does, which, is phenomenal. And thank God that we have an outlet like that. So I think now is the time for people to become more aware of these issues and make a difference, because, as Nigella was saying, in terms of an oxygen source, let alone what's on your plate for dinner, if the oceans die, there's really no hope for us, I think, for the future. So, this is the generation that can really make a difference.
I think Kate's absolutely right. I mean, I had that epiphany when I was still working with land animals, because yeah. I'm a biologist by profession. I switched from being an academic to the kind of job that I have now. I ran a nonprofit about birds, actually, in Salt Lake City before I came here to run the aquarium, because I cared so much about connecting the public to science and to the environment. Because just like Kate, I felt that huge disconnect. And I think a lot of other scientists feel the same way. The traditional way in science is it trickles down to the public often 30 years later through scientific papers, and we don't have that time. We have to act now.
Mm-hmm. So learn how to snorkel and get under the waves and see what's going on down there.
Or go to the aquarium.
And come to the aquarium
exhibit.
Yes, because not everyone can dive and snorkel. So if you can't do that, come to the aquarium or go out snorkeling with the aquarium. We do teach people how to do that and in a very safe environment. There's nothing more exciting than seeing the real thing.
Aquarium.ucsd.edu, also sdcoastkeeper.org. Nigella Hilgarth, Kate Hanley, wonderful having you ladies on the program today. Really enjoyed having you here. Enjoyed the conversation. I learned a lot. The great thing about doing this show is I always learn something. And stay in touch, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. Thanks again to Kate Hanley from San Diego Coastkeeper and Nigella Hilgarth from the Birch Aquarium at Scripps for joining us. And for more information on the Birch Aquarium at Scripps and to learn more about marine protected areas, as well as a host of online learning opportunities and outings with the aquarium to go tide pooling, whale watching and snorkeling, go to www.aquarium.ucsd.edu. That's aquarium.ucsd.edu. And as far as Kate and San Diego Coast Keeper are concerned, check out San Diego Coast Keeper's website at www.sdcoastkeeper.org for not only one-stop shopping on a host of marine and coastal-related matters, but also to get information on a variety of campaigns and activities like beach cleanups and plastic bag reduction and reporting pollution, sdcoastkeeper.org. And for more information on the Marine Life Protection Act, Kate mentioned a couple of websites. You can go to the California Department of Fish and Games page on marine reserves at www.dfg.ca.gov/MPLA. That's DFG for Department of Fish and Game, dfg.ca.gov/MPLA. And you can also go to caloceans.org. That's www.caloceans.org. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media, and as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, you're welcome to get a hold of me. Go ahead and send me an email at tommy@fm949sd.com. And for more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, you can go to the Tree Huggers International page at the FM 94.9 website, www.fm949sd.com/treehuggers. Or just go to the FM 94.9 homepage and click on the Tree Huggers International logo. I'm Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 5:30 with another take on natural science and environmental affairs in our corner of Southern California. But in the meantime, get ready for another edition of Nina Blackwood's New Wave Nation next on FM 94.9. Have a great Sunday and a good week. Be well.